This session is session 310, Archival Outreach through the Breath of Life Institute. It's a one-hour session, and we have three speakers. We will each speak for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll have some time for discussion at the end, so we really encourage you to provide comments or ask questions toward the end. In this morning's session, we're reporting on an outreach and training institute called the Breath of Life Archival Institute for Indigenous Languages. The program theme of Beyond Borders asked us to, quote, arrive at a more inclusive and holistic view of the great work of archives. And that's what this program, Breath of Life, has done for me as an archivist. And in fact, not only that, but it's what got me involved in archives in the first place. It's what pointed me down the path toward becoming an archivist. I organized this panel not only to report on an outreach and education initiative, but also to share some elements of the Breath of Life program that I hope other people will find useful in their archival outreach. Two elements in particular are that in this program, we promote collaboration among archivists, scholars, and communities of heritage, and there's a really nice flow of knowledge in multiple directions there. And second, we combine training in a subject matter and training in research skills in this program. So the subject matter is linguistics, and we teach the basics of linguistics in this program, but we also talk a lot about developing research skills, and we think that's a successful combination to combine subject matter and research skills. Breath of Life, of course, is devoted to linguistics, but I think the elements of this program could be equally applicable in other topics, especially family history or local history. I will give some brief background on the Breath of Life program, and then we will have two speakers who participated in last summer's program, and they'll each report on their involvement. Second, after me, will be Dr. Donna Miranda Begay. She's the tribal chairwoman of the Tabatalabal tribe, and we're very honored to have her here today. She flew in from Sacramento this morning, and her plane got in at 7:30, so we're so happy she was able to make it. She and her cousin, Betsy Johnson, and Lindsay Marian, who's a linguist, participated in the program last summer, and she will be sharing her tribe's experience of the Breath of Life program. Leanda Gahagan worked as the reference archivist at the Smithsonian's National Anthropological Archives for 4 years, and she was in charge of reference and managed the reading room. So she created instructional curriculum for this program as well as other educational programs at the National Anthropological Archives. She'll speak to the challenges that the NAA staff had responding to this workshop. I think it was a huge bombardment for them, I'm sure. Currently, Leanda is chair of the Museum Archives Section, and she's an adult librarian at the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Library System in North Carolina. And my name is Lisa Conathan. I was the co-director of Breath of Life last summer. I'm an archivist at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library in Yale University. And I will again co-direct the Breath of Life Institute in 2013. We have secured funding to go back in the summer of 2013 and do this program again. So get ready, Smithsonian, here we come. The 2011 Breath of Life last summer was the first one with a national scope, but the program has a long history in California, where UC Berkeley has been hosting Breath of Life workshops since the mid-1990s. So to understand the impetus for this program, I'm just going to say a few words about Native California languages. Today, there are at least 50 languages spoken within the state of California. And this great diversity reflects a diversity of the whole western coast of North America. It's, in fact, one of the most diverse regions in the world in terms of languages spoken. This tremendous diversity in the state of California means that many of the communities, the individual communities, are quite small, and the number of speakers of the languages is quite small as well. Many languages, in fact, only have a handful of fluent speakers. They might have one or two or five fluent speakers. They might have no fluent speakers. So in order to protect speakers of native languages and foster an environment in which people can learn the languages, many tribal communities and linguists and scholars have been working to revitalize native languages, that is, teach them, learn them, and speak them. Breath of Life began as this sort of effort to help people learn, teach, and speak native languages, focusing on what we call sleeping languages, that is, languages that don't currently have fluent speakers, that have that are sleeping in the archives, in the documentation, in archives, libraries, or in individual collections in people's homes. The small number of speakers of many California languages, together with the rich history of anthropological documentation, missionary documentation, create the motivation to turn to archives to use these materials to learn and speak native languages. Breath of Life created an opportunity to discover what documentation existed at UC Berkeley and elsewhere, and to learn the linguistic concepts and terminology necessary to use this documentation and connect with other people who are carrying out similar research. I came to Breath of Life as a graduate student in linguistics in 1998. I served as a linguist for about 8 years. I worked with a few different native California communities, so I taught the basics of linguistic structure and terminology, and in turn, I learned about native California heritage. In 2009, I teamed up with Professor Leanne Hinton at UC Berkeley to put together a national program with a larger scope, and that's the program we're reporting on today. The first one was last summer. We're hoping it's going to be an ongoing educational institute, and we're working to secure funding to make that happen. With the help of several experienced Breath of Life faculty and with staff of the Smithsonian Institution and the Library of Congress, we funded and organized this workshop last summer. Oh, I put this map up, which I know is very difficult for you to see. You can't see the individual words, but you can at least see the blobs of color on there, just to make the point that on the West Coast, there are so many native languages compared to the rest of the country. If you look in the Central and Eastern North America, there are still a great many different languages spoken, but the blobs of color are larger, and that just indicates that there is less diversity in the rest of the country than in California. Last summer, about 60 people, Native American language learners and linguists, came to Washington, D.C. for a 2-week workshop in June. We stayed there for 2 whole weeks. We stayed in dorms at George Washington University, which was great because it's really expensive to stay in hotels in Washington, D.C. We formed 20 teams based on language, so there were about 20 languages represented. Some languages were very close to one another and would form a team with a few different varieties or languages together. And each team had at least one linguist with formal academic training and at least one native language researcher. The teams came to Breath of Life with many different goals. Some people had political goals. Some people had spiritual goals or cultural goals. But the overarching element was to use archival material to learn and teach native languages. And it sparked unprecedented use of certain collections in the Library of Congress and at the Smithsonian. And I think we might hear a little bit about that from Leanda. There were a few key differences to this program from the previous program in Berkeley. In Berkeley, it was confined to Native California languages, and in this program, we took people from all over the country, so there was a greater diversity of participants. We also included people who have fluent speakers in a speech community. I mentioned before that the Berkeley program had focused on sleeping languages, that is, languages that don't currently have fluent speakers. In this national program, we included also communities who have fluent speakers. We believe that the use of archives can benefit all Native communities who are learning their languages and not necessarily only be a last resort for people who don't have fluent speakers. And in fact, some of the fluent speakers were the ones who were able to give the archives the most information about the material. They would sometimes correct the cataloging information or be able to provide a lot of descriptive context to the material because they knew a lot about the material, more than the archivists. And I put up this map here. This is a map of where people came from for Breath of Life. So you see that California is very well represented, and that reflects the fact that this program had been going on in California for 25 years. Also, you'll see that Oklahoma is well represented, and that's because Oklahoma is a very diverse state in terms of the tribes and languages spoken there. But we had people from all over the U.S., including the Northeast, and we had people from Canada as well. Everything about the planning and execution of this workshop was collaborative. The organizing committee identified several institutions and collections in advance, and for about 2 years ahead of time, we had meetings with representatives from each of these institutions to plan this institute. The staff of each institution worked in advance to identify material, to prepare it, to make it ready to be used for research, to digitize portions of material, and to make special accommodations during the institute, including modifications to their reading room space. The National Anthropological Archives, in particular, had to accommodate far more people than they usually would on a typical research day. The partners included museums as well as libraries and archives, so we had the opportunity to tour material collections in two museums. And so we got behind-the-scenes tour at the National Museum for the American Indian and at the Natural History Museum as well. This institute was supported by a grant from the National Science Foundation Documenting Endangered Languages Program. And the DEL program is one that started off focusing on funding field work to create new documentation of endangered languages. Over the years, it has expanded its concept of what constitutes documentation of endangered languages, and it's much more open now to funding both revitalization programs and also these sorts of research programs that promote the use of existing documentation. This is a typical document that people at Breath of Life would have been using, and in fact, this is Donna's language. So I just put this up, it might be a little blurry, but I just put this up to try to provide a sense of what it would be like to come to documentation like this, not necessarily knowing a lot of the language in advance, not necessarily knowing much about the practices of the anthropologists who might have been creating this documentation, and to look at these documents and try to learn your language. It's in fact incredibly difficult to do that, and it's incredibly rewarding when you can pick elements out of this documentation and put them together in new ways and create new language. These are just a few excerpts from the evaluations of Breath of Life, and what struck me about the evaluations is that there's such a strong emotional current that runs through this program because there's a sense that people are reclaiming history and culture. People are often learning about their own direct relatives who might have spoken to anthropologists or missionaries and whose documentation exists in the archive. And so it creates a very touching emotional environment, and it's really wonderful to see that. And as a linguist and as an archivist, it really provides a new sense of meaning to the work that I do. I started off very much as a scientist, taking a very straight scientific approach to this, and it has built up so many layers of meaning over the years as I've participated in programs such as this. The Smithsonian has put together a few promotional videos documenting this event, Breath of Life. They have a program called the Recovering Voices Program, which focuses on language endangerment and revitalization. And this Breath of Life really fit into that existing program. And so they created, I'm just going to play this 3-minute video, and then I'm going to pass the mic to Dr. Donna Miranda Begay.
Too loud. Life is training workshops through which members of Native American tribes can learn how to work with archival materials, and specifically learn how to extract information from these documents that can serve their needs for revitalization of their languages and cultures.
Oh, this is...
I'm sorry. So these videos just came out this week, and they were just sent to me while I was at the conference. And they told me, I think there's some problem with the audio. And when I was listening to it just on my laptop, it was quiet like that, but you could still hear it. And now I'm realizing that as it's going through the speakers, the audio is so quiet in these sections that you can't hear it. So I apologize for that. They're still in the process of editing these videos. Well, I guess I'll just make the point that the Smithsonian had this whole team of people who attended the workshop, and they produced these promotional videos that they're then going to blast out and use to promote their own program, Recovering Voices, but also promote Breath of Life, which is going to take place again in 2013. So I'm just going to skip the rest of that video since the audio really wasn't coming through. You couldn't hear it at all, could you? No? Okay. It's hard to tell from up here. Okay, at this point, so as I said, Next Institute, June 10th in DC. And at this point, I will pass over the mic to Donna.
Yeah. All right. Tumadak, that means good morning in my language. Tangwang Naang means my name is Donna Miranda Begay, and I'm from the Kern Valley area. It's about an hour east of Bakersfield and the very southern slope of the Sierra Mountain Range. That's where I live on an allotment, 160-acre tribal allotment given to us back in, I think, 1892 under the Dawes Act. So I was asked to come talk today about the experience from our tribal perspective, being Tabat Talabo. That's five syllables. I always tell people, if you could say Massachusetts, you could say Tabat Talabo. Come on now. It's like Yurok, right? anyway, so we went to the Breath of Life last year, and it just seemed like it was just the other day, because there was just so much information there. And I was just amazed at the experience. And my cousin, Betsy, and another cousin of mine, Louise, encouraged me to apply, and I was like, Breath of Life, what is that? And so when they told me about the focus of being linguistic and also on research, my interest was more on the research part. You know, I'm learning the language, but I also wanted to learn more about our tribe, so I jumped on it. I said, okay, I'm going to fill out my app and go. And so as Lisa had pointed out, this particular map is being seen a lot, but it's actually illustrating, and not all tribes in California agree with this map, by the way. This is an academic linguistic perspective of language groups of California, and there's 63 of them here being displayed, and we are one of the 63 of these language programs here, of language groups here in this Tabat Talabo area. We also are kind of clumped in with Uto Aztecan language group. And I think at this point, a lot of the linguistic folks that are looking at us saying, you know, you guys are so unique, you almost can create your own branch, you know, and so it's pretty cool. But we don't know yet, because we got to study more about ourselves and find out more research about what's going on with the language base. So let me give you a view of our tribe, the Tabat Talabo tribe. Again, I mentioned we're located in Kern Valley. That's my view from my house, from the allotment land. That's our dirt road coming up the hill there from Kern Valley. And in the valley area, that's Audubon country. That's where the bird preserve is. And straight ahead is a mountain called Nichols Peak. That's the Anglo name. But our name is called Lelet. Lelet means where the eagles live. And that's where we're from. So we have 287 tribal members. And right now, we don't really have a fluent speaker. I will say one of the major outcomes of the Breath of Life was that I got my cousin Betsy, who's our language a teacher to say, to start saying that our language was endangered versus she was saying our language was extinct. There's a real difference between extinct and endangered. And extinct means you have no documentation, you have no evidence, you have no recordings, you have no recall, you have nothing, zero. And endangered means you've got a little bit of hope out there. You just got to figure out how to revitalize it and who can help. And so we're on that threshold, but we're on a more positive endangered. We're not like down at the low spectrum of being extinct. So it's important that folks understand that, and I think that was one of the outcomes of attending the conference, because other folks were talking with Betsy about that term extinct. And then we have four people that are on the Pakenapul language team. And in our tribe, there's three bands. We have the Palakewanap and the Pakenapul and the Bakalanchi. That's easy for me to say, right? And those three distinct bands are based upon the geographical presence of these folks and how they speak. And we know, and in our circle, tribal circle, we know oral tradition that the Palakewanap and the Pakenapul people spoke the same dialect. But we weren't real sure about the Bakalanchi people. We think they spoke a little bit of our dialect, but we thought maybe they spoke a little more further north, like the Yokut language. And so we had never seen the Bakalanchi language written down before. We've heard little pieces of it in recordings and that. So going on to D.C., we were going to try to find out, you know, what was going on there. So the purpose for our tribe to attend was we were trying to preserve and be more involved with, you know, looking at our endangered language. And we lost our last fluent speaker back in 2009, you know, Jim Andreas. And it's really kind of scary, you know, when you are amongst a population, a native population, and you know you are it. This is it, you know. Today, the taxi cab driver asked me if I had any children. We had a nice conversation, and he got to the point where, oh, you have children. I was like, no, I don't. And I was kind of thinking, how sad, because we should be having more kids, because then it'll be more Tabata levels. But, oh, well. Well, I have family that have lots of kids, and I help raise my niece and nephew, so I always get out of it that way. But it's like we look at this population of 287 people, and no more fluent speaker, but we got four people who are trying to bring it back to teach it. And so having this program was so important for us. And then we went to Washington, D.C. also to deal with the NAGPRA, Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. That's a mouthful. And it's more targeted, that act is more targeted for federally recognized tribes. We're not federally recognized. So we need an academic leg to stand on when we go speak to the Smithsonian and try to get our little mummy child at the mouth of Kern Canyon by Bakersfield and claim her and say she belongs with us and she belongs in a place where she can be safely reburied. She doesn't belong in the mummy room. She needs to come home. So how do we get her home? We have to have the evidence of our existence, and our language is certainly that. Congressional representatives, meet with them. Who are you guys to call yourselves Tabata Lawal tribe? How are you a tribe? You know, and so it's kind of neat to be able to explain to congressional representatives about our history and have the proof in front of them. And then conducting the research, you know, we knew we were going to get copies of books and documentaries and things. We were going to try our best to get whatever we could back in D.C. So we stayed in D.C. We actually went there 2 weeks ahead of time, and then we spent the 2 weeks in the Breath of Life. So we spent 4 weeks in D.C. And the first 2 weeks, we dealt with our NAGPRA issue. We met on the left there. You can see that we're meeting with the Smithsonian folks from the Natural History of Museum, the Natural History of Man Museum. And then there in the center, we're actually looking at a Thule mat that's, and we're in the mummy room there. And we set this up ahead of time to make sure that we got there. This is just on our own. Our tribe did this. But as we were talking with representatives, we knew we needed to find something something come the next 2 weeks. We better find something that validates our existence, you know, in our language. And so we were doing that. We also got a preview of the anthropological archives, which later we went to through the Breath of Life. And so we got our own little tour just by ourselves with certain folks. And then we spent time at various museums, you know. And then we met with the federal acknowledgement folks with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because there's this lengthy process we have to go through to become federally recognized. So Department of Interior, and then we met with our congressional representatives. But here we go, Breath of Life. This is where you have three different perspectives. You know, we have two representatives from our tribe were selected. You had one linguistics individual. So we have the tribal chairwoman, you have your linguists, and then you have your language team, the program teacher, Betsy. And then we got to meet a lot of nice other tribal folks there, other linguists, got to get to know the organizers, and it was really nice and friendly and comfortable. And that's, you know, I'm not real comfortable in libraries. A lot of tribes aren't very comfortable in libraries because a lot of us didn't have libraries to begin with, you know, on a reservation. Rancherias and our allotment lands, and a lot of us are come from very rural, remote areas because that's where they place the Indians. And so, you know, so that's kind of where we come from. So when we came here, it was like, wow, we got to learn this stuff. But it was so well orchestrated that the learning was just doing, and we didn't really have to study anything. We just kind of were walked through things, and that was the beauty of it. And so our first strategy, at least for us, when we went to Breath of Life for archiving, this was what we wanted to do. We said, let's categorize what we learned in week one, and then we'll make another folder for week two, and that's how we're going to categorize things. And little did we know, we probably were going to tune that up a bit. Again, these are different focus points from my perspective of what I wanted to find out about. I wanted to find historic maps. I wanted to find photos, sound recordings. Our linguist, she wanted to use all the electronic search engines. She's going to download documents. She's going to focus on language. You know, she's going to, you know, really, really driven on the linguistic side. And then our language teacher, Betsy, she wanted to really interact with the people, you know, talk and share about lessons learned in teaching language. And then, she also was very interested in touching things, you know, like baskets and that. So. And then we knew what we needed to do, too. I know at least Lindsay and I, the linguists that came to us back in the late 1800s to early 1900s, we know that they came to us, they wrote about us, but we wanted to find their source documents. And so J.P. Harrington's a good example, and he's in the crowd there with the linguist there on the left, and then his book. But his book is kind of like somebody else wrote that book based upon the source documents. And then we found his original photos to the right in a container there. And it was actually found by another tribe, the Tohon tribe, who have just recently got their federal recognition reestablished in January. And they shared that box with us. It says, Donna, isn't this your great-grandfather? And so, oh my gosh, it was like great. So we did that. And then there's all kinds of things in regards to C. Hart Merriam, Waterman, I said Harrington earlier, Powers we talked about. These are people that studied our tribe in our valley, and a lot of them, they did travel throughout California. So this is actually a vocabulary collection from C. Hart Merriam, and it says Tabatalabala. That's how they would say our tribe, Tabatalabala. And this was done in 1932, but he also came to us in 1902. So there was like over a 30-year stretch from his first visit to his second visit. And I got to actually touch his journals, you know. It was pretty cool to read his journals, and he lived in Washington, D.C., and then the Library of Congress, all these folks, the first time we got to see the field notes of our two dialects, we actually got to see both dialects for the first time, and we wanted so bad to touch the documents, but they were only on those tables for display that day. And then we set up an appointment, and they actually let us hold the documents and go through them, and we took with our cameras, we took pictures of page by page by page, the field notes. And so we, this is the things that we capture. This is like the Tabatalabala, and this is the field notes by C. Hart Merriam. And then here's the Tabatalabala more. And then this is the Pakenapul, the Bakalanchi. And this is the one we were looking for, this dialect. We've never seen it written down before. And so we were so excited. And as I think Lisa mentioned earlier, you know, you could say so much in a presentation like this, but in that picture where we're holding our documents, we actually had to wipe our eyes because we had cried. It was so compelling to hold your language and to see that our relatives trusted an outsider and sat with that person and said, here's how you say one, Cheech, Wo, Pai, Nanao, Mahaijin. And they wrote it down, and it was like, that was so neat to see. And then to see that other dialect, the one we don't speak, but that is part of our tribe. It was like, wow, that's good stuff. So I can go on and on, but these are all the maps that we found, too. So it does solidify the fact that we have always been there. There's Tabatalabala, you know, in the map. There's the digital recordings of our great-grandfather. This was done originally on the wax cylinders in the 1930s, and J.P. Harrington did this. I just hit the space key on this one real quick, and I'll be probably white. Whoops. Yeah. So this one is my great-grandfather, Stebbins Miranda, singing a song for a fiesta, a party, you know, a big gathering event, a social event.
Stebbins Miranda.
Great. So you have a sample of, did you hear that? You know, imagine he's like singing in a big, this big thing at him, you know, and it's pretty cool. I saw some pictures of Harrington and the device that he carried around and that. So getting back into the next thing is, now you saw my first strategy, right, of how we're going to archive. And now, you know, after the first week, oh my gosh, you know, it was so, there was so much information. We had lesson plans, homework. I didn't know they were going to give us homework. Homework, and then we had pictures, notes, recordings. We had the walk-around tour pictures. We had research materials that were so important. And it just went on. And for us, we said, well, we're going to get stuff for our tribal members. We're going to share this for them, for our tribal office, for our language program. We never even thought until we got home the next day. I think we got home like 4 in the morning, and the next, that same day at 6 o'clock, we promised the Kern Valley Historic Society that we would do a presentation about our tribe. Oh my gosh. We had to hurry and scramble because we had so much new information to share with them, and they were so in awe with this effort, you know. And so now we share our data and information with the community, other tribes, the public agencies, the academic folks, and others, and they're just so excited. We even started drafting a new book, too, on this adventure that we had. And then all of this comes to play that, what do we do with this research? What do we do with this information? Well, we've been, as recent as last week, I was talking with State Parks of California about off-road vehicle park they're proposing to buy at Jawbone Canyon area, and how that's our cultural area. And now we have a leg to stand on academically. Now we have plenty of evidence and proof, and so they work with us government to government. You don't have to be federally recognized to exercise your sovereignty and your ability to protect your cultural areas. So that's so important. And so we continue to work with the Corps of Engineers in protecting our cultural sites near and around Lake Isabella. And we educate some of our young folks about what we learn. And there's all kinds of outcomes, and I won't go through all of them. I think the one thing I like is that we have a new knowledge of our song. You heard Stebbins sing, and he kind of sang his tune was, ha, 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 ha. So we were, our final project for Breath of Life was to come up, we came up with a song. We I picked up a song, and it's called Big Knowledge. We have knowledge. We have our language. And I thought I could get it down right. I'll sing it real quick, and then I'm ending because I know we got another speaker here. So it goes, Egeawan magila magila, Egeawan magila. A doogie loose magi alawi nuts. So, and that's a dedication to the new sound that we heard, the new tone that came from Grandpa Stebbins. And that's because the Breath of Life folks showed us the avenues for finding more about us. And I just can't say enough. And there's some of the links that I used in reference to this presentation. You guys are always welcome to get copies of stuff that we put that at least our tribe puts together. I do have about 13 now copies of this DVD. It's about 33 minutes of our trip to Washington, D.C. and things I talked about here. If you are from the same organization, maybe you could share, but I only have like 13 of them, so I tried to make extra copies last night. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa, for that nice introduction, and thank you, Donna, for sharing your experiences as a Breath of Life participant. As Lisa mentioned, my name's Leandica Hagen, and I was the reference archivist for the National Anthropological Archives at the Smithsonian. While I was at the NAA, I had the opportunity to plan the research activities for the involvement of the Breath of Life Institute, and it was a really great opportunity. So during this presentation, I'll just provide a brief introduction to the National Anthropological Archives and identify a few challenges that we had with hosting the Breath of Life Institute and explain how we overcame those challenges, and then give some tips for next time if your institution is going to host something similar or if you're ever faced with a large amount of researchers at once, which we definitely were. So the National Anthropological Archives is part of the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History. And for the rest of my presentation, I may refer to the National Anthropological Archives as the NAA. So the NAA is the nation's main repository of original documentation for spoken, endangered, and extinct Native American languages. Approximately 250 languages are represented in the collection, and documentation for many of these languages isn't found elsewhere. The archive traces its origins to an 1879 act of Congress creating an official repository for documents concerning American Indians that were collected by the Great Western Surveys of the United States. The archive was then directed by John Wesley Powell, and under his direction, the founding collection of 670 manuscripts increased to more than 5,000. When Powell was sending early anthropologists into the field to collect information about American Indians, their language, their culture, and to also to take photographs. The collection includes vocabularies, grammars, lexicons, questionnaires, texts, narratives, sound recordings, photographs, maps. The NAA also collects and preserves historical and contemporary anthropological materials related to the four fields of anthropology. So not only do we have this core collection of linguistic material, but there's also contemporary material about anthropologists and the field of anthropology. During my years at the National Anthropological Archives, I worked with a number of tribal delegations, Native artists, and others who are working on language revitalization projects. And the NAA really does work with groups of Native people to try to learn more about its holdings, to improve our catalog records. And I've always found this type of collaboration and projects really useful, especially with language researchers, because I find that people who are trying to revitalize their language really are very appreciative of any research help you can give them, and they find the collections uniquely personal and emotional, as we've heard from Donna prior. So for Breath of Life, we encountered three main challenges with hosting the Institute, and they related to staffing, space, and collection access.
So I'll identify the challenges and then explain our responses. One of the first challenges that we had with Breath of Life was finding additional staff to accommodate. I'm not sure if we mentioned, but there were approximately 60 people that were part of the Breath of Life Institute that came to the archive for 2 weeks. So I was the only person handling research visits, and I could only take 10 researchers at one time by myself, and even 10 researchers was pushing it. So handling 60 researchers was definitely going to be a challenge, and I needed to find additional staff. So what I did is I hired 2 full-time graduate student interns in library science programs, and then I also hired a full-time undergraduate intern who was in a linguistics honor student. And to be honest, I was a little hesitant to hire an undergraduate intern for this project, but I found it worked out really well because I was able to give her tasks that just weren't appropriate for my graduate interns. I also utilized my current half-time volunteers and interns, and I had the advantage of utilizing almost all of my coworkers and their interns and volunteers to help out. In preparation for the Institute, I planned a number of orientation sessions for everyone that was working with Breath of Life participants. And during these sessions, I relied heavily on the protocols for Native American archival materials. I found that the protocols worked really well to explain the complexities and the challenges of working with Native American archival material for people who had not worked with that type of material before or who had not worked with groups before. And we eventually had, I think, over 11 people that were responsible for watching the reading room and helping with the research activities of Breath of Life. So staffing was a challenge, but it was something that was overcome easily with just thinking ahead and planning and making sure that everyone was comfortable with working with that many researchers. Our second challenge with hosting Breath of Life was finding enough space for 60 researchers. This is an image of one of the orientation sessions that we had for the Breath of Life participants that just introduced participants to our catalog, explaining how to search the catalog, how to work in the archive. And this is in our main reading room, which could only seat about 11 researchers. So with 60 researchers coming, I needed to find additional space. And luckily, I was able to secure space in a conference room and a library. These weren't ideal, but we were really fortunate to have that extra space. And so I broke down the basic supplies of what makes a room a reading room, which, you know, would be pencils, forms, appropriate table space, and cart space for everyone. And so each reading room, we moved all the supplies in, and then I made sure to have enough staff dedicated to each room so that, you know, the room was always supervised and appropriate for research. And so I'm really thankful to my Smithsonian colleagues that lent their extra space. This is a shot of researchers working in the conference room. And as you can see, it's pretty small, and we just had that one long table. But it was a good creative solution to our spacing needs. And this is a shot of someone working in the library, which actually worked well. It was just a research library in the building, and we made sure to have enough space so that people could lay out collections and use their computers and had enough outlets for laptops and so forth. And here's another shot of people working in the library. Our final challenge, which was the biggest challenge we had with hosting Breath of Life, was collection access. I knew that Breath of Life research is collaborative, so we would need workable copies of collection material for all participants. And we also needed multiple copies of collection material because different groups of researchers might be looking at the same item because it may have a vocabulary of a variety of different languages, or it may be unidentified California languages, and so we would want the California groups to all have an opportunity to look at that same document. So we definitely needed multiple copies of one document. So at first, we thought maybe we could photocopy our collection material and provide it to participants that way. But after talking to previous linguistic researchers, we realized that photocopying would not be the best because, as Lisa showed in the slide before, most of these documents had different color ink, like or different annotations or interlinear text translations, and those different shades of ink had meaning, and it would be lost in black and white photocopies. And color copies were just out of the question due to the expense. So after evaluating all our options, we decided to provide digital copies of selected material to Breath of Life participants. And we worked with Breath of Life organizers, and we also had funds from a Save America's Treasure grant that we used to digitize collection material related to Breath of Life research. The NAA received a $323,000 Save America's Treasure grant to digitize a large number of our early language collection material and also to provide some conservation work for this material as well. So it just kind of worked out really nicely that we were able to combine our Save America's Treasure grant, funds from Breath of Life, and other funds to digitize material. We couldn't digitize everything that everyone wanted to look at, so we had to select what needed to be digitized. And we formed a team. We worked with Lisa and others, and we also worked with Dr. Gabriela Perez-Baez, who you saw in the video. She's the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History Curator of Linguistics, to select different important linguistic texts that would be most valuable to Breath of Life participants. And we wanted each participant to take away one electronic copy of their language material. And for some language groups, we had a lot of material to choose from. And for other language groups, there maybe were one or two documents that were identified as their language group in the archive. So it really was a collaborative effort to identify the material to digitize. We loaded the material that we digitized onto flash drives and gave those flash drives to participants when they came to the archive on their first day. The flash drives also had maps and other information that they needed about like their dorm room, maps of DC, information on how to work in the archive. I think there may have been some lesson plans. And we found that the flash drive delivery of the electronic material worked really well, and it was something that I think should continue into the future. I have a couple of slides. This is an example of one of the vocabularies that participants would look at. And on the left, you see the English names, and then on the right is a language. A lot of the material needed to have minor conservation work done before we could digitize or before we could provide access to participants. So here's an example. This document had tape removed. And here's a shot of one of the digitization interns digitizing the collection material. So in closing, I'll just identify three tips that if your institution is faced with a similar research opportunity. And my first tip is to don't immediately say no, even if it seems impossible, which Breath of Life seemed kind of impossible to us when we first heard about it, just because it was so many researchers at once. I'm really glad that we didn't say no and didn't say, you know, this is too hard, because it really was a unique opportunity. It's so important to language research, and it's so important to the individual participants. It makes a huge difference. And so if you can think of a way to do it, it's worth all the effort that goes into it. And my second tip is when you do agree to do a seemingly impossible research institute, just to make sure that you ask for help. This really was a collaborative experience. There's no way that we could have done it without the help of Smithsonian colleagues. And definitely make sure you work with the organizers. Lisa was really great to work with, and we helped plan the Institute from the get-go, and it's really good to be involved in that planning process when you're coming from the archive to make sure that you can manage expectations of what people think is possible, and also to make sure to work with the participants at the start to just also help them understand what is possible in your archive and what is not possible. And my last tip, which I think we can all improve upon, is just to make sure when you do have that such a great group of researchers at your institute that you have a way to capture that knowledge and record that knowledge and update your catalog records, because you do have experts that know a lot more about your collections than you do. And if there's, I don't know, forms or documentation, just recording the experience can really help everyone. It can help future researchers and then also help the archive. So that's all, and then I'd just like to say thank you to everyone that helped me, and I hope we have enough time for questions.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you, Leanda. And I'm also really glad that you guys didn't say no, because I think when we were putting this together, we didn't quite realize the impact we were going to have on the host archives, both the Library of Congress and at the Smithsonian. And we were just like, oh, so you can handle this, right? This will be okay. And then we realized how much work it was going to be for people. And everyone really stepped up. It was amazing how much work they put into it, and I'm really grateful for that. So we do have a few minutes for any questions or comments. We'd love to hear from you. Hi, Susan. Yeah. So I'm just going to repeat the question, because this session is being recorded. The question is that we gave participants documents on their flash drives. Were we also able to include audiovisual material? Can you speak into the microphone?
We were able to give some sound recordings to participants. As you saw on one of Donna's slides, we didn't put them on a flash drive. I think we put them on a CD. Finding material to give to participants was challenging, because we didn't want to give any language group, you know, more than another language group, or we wanted it to be equal. So that's, we really relied on Lisa and Gabriella to identify the best material or the most useful material that we could digitize for the groups. And then, of course, they could order more material from us. We provided some free of charge.
So, and I just wanted to underline the fact that we, not me personally, but the organizers looked at a lot of this material in advance, so people didn't just come in. Because archival research takes so much time, we all know that, we knew what was the best bet for them already coming in, and we had planned that in advance. And the things we chose to digitize were things we thought would be particularly useful for everyone. It wasn't just like people walked in and then looked at the catalog and said, okay, what's related to my language?
My experience, too, and I got the flash drive, and I do a lot of technology stuff, you know, and it's like, I didn't look at that flash drive until day three or four, and I said, what's on this flash drive, by the way, anyway? So I pop it in, I look at it, and I go, oh, my God, this is all about us. You know, I thought it was just like a broad thing, but it was specific to the Tabata Labo. So my cousin Betsy and I and our linguist Lindsay, who worked with us, we all got, you know, our individual flash drives, but same information. But it was just like, wow, this is just like, they did all this work before we got here. You know, that was pretty cool.
Anyone else? I'm just going to repeat the question. The question was, you put the material on the flash drives. Is that digitized material then made more widely available? And I think the answer is they ended up in the catalog, right?
Yes. Because most of the material that was digitized from our Save America's Treasure grant, which meant that the material was being placed online through our catalog. But most of the material that was digitized and provided to the tribes hadn't been digitized before and hadn't been available online.
And our tribe was sponsored by the Tule River Indian Reservation Tribe, and they paid for our whole way for the 4 weeks, and we did spend 2 weeks, though, in the dorms and kept down the cost. But we were able to procure the moving of the recordings from cassette tape to digital, and you know, it was about $500 for about 12 songs to be moved over, and therefore it's now available for folks now that want to do the research on it. But there was some that was already digitalized, and we were able to download those from the internet, but we got these other ones because it's amazing in the archives too. Family names. My grandfather's first name is Esteban, but he's also known as Stephen, and then another one is Stefana. You know, so it's like there's these different names for him, and you have to find. But his last name has always been Miranda, and consistently. So we found some his name in various ways in the archives, but it was the same person.
So this program did spark a bunch of digitization. Institutions were able to kind of take advantage of this program to either use existing funds or to get other funds to digitize a bunch of material, both audiovisual and, well, it was really audio. I don't think there were video. Audio and paper. Was there another question over here somewhere? I thought I saw. Oh, yeah. I'm just going to paraphrase. Mm-hmm. Great, I'm glad to hear that. I'm just going to paraphrase for the sake of the recording that Gina, who works at the National Anthropological Archives, was saying that leading up to the Institute, it was quite intimidating, but that it was an incredibly energizing experience and allowed the staff there to engage with the material in new ways. I hope that was a fair paraphrase. Okay, at this point, I think we're at the end of our time. So thank you so much for coming to this morning session.